from Canto 3, Chapter 30, Text 32. It's not a nice chapter. It's a description of adverse fruit of activities. And the chapter just has three more verses. Maybe we'll cover some extra ones. The context is Kapila Deva is describing, broadly speaking, describing to Devahuti the process of devotional service. Chapter 28, chapter 29, chapter 25. So the process of devotional service. And then how to do it and what happens when you do it and what's the ultimate goal or objective when engaging in devotional service. And kind of an impetus to engage in devotional service, at least for some people, is what happens if you don't. The consequences. Or the nature of material life is minus God is at the center. And if when that vacancy is there, God is at the center, something else takes the center. And me. But it's not even me, it's a false conception of me. False ego overwhelms the living entity. And instead of thinking of myself, I think of something that I'm not, and that becomes the center. And that keeps changing because time moves matter and keeps changing and changing and endlessly changing. But the center is what I'm not. Ma, ya, not this. Just with you. From yesterday evening, citing the verse, we're entitled to perform prescribed duty, but not entitled to the fruits of your duty. Do you know that verse? Karma nid avikaraste ma palesu kadachana. Ma palesu. Pala is fruit, and ma palesu is you're not entitled to the fruit. Ma palesu. So, ma ya. Not this. Being in maya is to accept what isn't to be what is, and what is to be what isn't. It's a bad program. You throw away, you get a better program. But many people are hooked on maya's program. So, that's this chapter. Description of adverse fruit of activity. So, in order to pursue maya, you need to work hard to get more maya. And if more maya doesn't work, you just get a different variety of maya. And mix the varieties of maya and try it this way and try it that way. And it's endless. Permutations and combinations of what isn't maya. Losing oneself. It's a bad program. So these final three verses, it's summarizing the consequences of fruitive activities. It's against adverse. It's against the interest of the living entity. It's against the interest of the purpose of human life. It directly heading in the wrong direction, very enthusiastically. So, text 32 reads, summary, thus, by the arrangement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the maintainer of kinsmen is put into hellish a hellish condition to suffer for his sinful activities, like a man who has lost his will. So the if God isn't in the center, then it's really, really easy. It's too easy to just go over from the center left or right, or way far right or way far left, or in the ditch or in the ditch, or hit the guardrail and spin around by deviating from codes of Dharma to live according to the principles given by the Creator of everything, how to live peacefully, sanely, happily, and properly within this world and with the human form of life. So those that are averse to Krishna being at the center, then invariably they'll engage in detrimental activity, including sinful activity, and the consequence of that is everything that they have accumulated for themselves or their extended self, family members, certainly is going to be taken at the time of death, minimally, and then the destination of a living entity for those unavoidable, certain to happen sinful activities is descending to a hellish condition after this life, however one may be apparently prospering in this life. Adverse fruit of activities and their consequences. Purport. The example set herein is that the sinful person suffers just like a man who has lost his wealth. The human form of body is achieved by the conditioned soul after many, many births and is a very valuable asset. Instead of utilizing this life to get liberation, if one uses it simply for the purpose of maintaining a so-called family and therefore performs foolish and unauthorized actions, he is compared to a man who has lost his wealth or who, upon losing it, laments. When wealth is lost, there is no use lamenting, but as long as there is wealth, one has to utilize it properly and thereby gain eternal profit. It may be argued that when a man leaves his money earned by sinful activities, he also leaves his sinful activities here with his money. But it is especially mentioned herein that by superior arrangement, the Sanskrit word is given, daive na saditam. Although the man leaves behind him his sinfully earned money, he carries the effect of it. When a man steals some money, if he is caught and agrees to return it, he is not freed from criminal punishment by the law of the state. Even though he returns the money, he has to undergo the punishment. Similarly, the money earned by a criminal process may be left by a man when dying, but by superior arrangement he carries with him the effect. And therefore, he has to suffer hellish life. Boring. The complexity of materialistic life is kind of invisible. Fortunately, through hearing of scripture, then one can see those things that one can otherwise not see. That's one appreciation of what's being presented here. Person can say, for example, a person can say, karma, you know, that's a belief, I don't believe it. prove it. You know, defiant. I can do what I want to do. And I'm not answerable to anybody. So one can say like that, but, you know, is it real or is it not real? How does it work if it's real? So someone may argue. If all of this is temporary and I leave it behind, so what? Because everyone else has to leave everything behind. So I leave everything behind. But it's the law of karma is subtle, such that even if you leave everything behind, you don't leave the effect of wrongdoings behind. There's consequences. The adverse fruit of activities is quite severe in this life and the next life. The metaphor that's being used is like a man who loses all his wealth. There's many such references, similar references, when somebody who is very poor somehow by windfall they get some wealth, something, whatever wealth might represent to them, and then short time passes and they misplace it or they lose it or it's stolen or something. And the Bhagavatam uses that example of the human form of life that's misused. It's so valuable. And then one laments. You didn't have wealth. Now all of a sudden you have wealth, and all of a sudden you don't have wealth again. Whether it's an individual or a family or a nation or a group of people or something, the laws of nature are such that each of us is destined to a certain amount of prosperity, and that certain amount of prosperity will come to you anyway. Whether you, doesn't mean we become lazy, we, in the position of being the servant of Krishna, we serve Krishna like this atyahara, over endeavoring, or prayasa, excuse me, over endeavoring. We endeavor, it is a matter of service to Krishna, but one that doesn't have Krishna, then you endeavor, and you're frustrated if you don't get the fruit of your endeavor, and you're frustrated if you get the fruit of your endeavor because it didn't satisfy, and so you make more endeavor. It's a never-ending cycle of fruitive activity. And I lost the thread of what I wanted to bring out. Yeah. And then you lose it, whatever it is that you have. And the valuable thing that's being spoken of here is the human form of life. You have it. Those that don't have a picture of the soul's transmigration aren't necessarily going to appreciate this is a very valuable opportunity in the cycle of birth and death to have a human form of life and use it properly. Rather, just a facility for enjoying the senses, and it's a good machine for enjoying the senses. Let me enjoy. Why not? Then lose it. And the consequence of losing it is go downward. That's primarily the function, as far as I understand it, of this chapter and life. Engage in devotional service, and there's consequences if you don't. Now, somebody could just take that, my goodness, I really don't want devotional service, but I don't want the misery, and so I'll do devotional service because I don't want misery. Well, that's one impetus. But then when the misery that one is presently experiencing subsides, just like the four types of pious people that render devotional service to Krishna, when one of those four things subsides and economic prosperity is there, or the stress and tension is relieved, or your curiosity is satisfied, etc., then the impetus for involving in devotional service also diminishes, and it's business as usual again. The point is, this default mode of primitive activities, it appears as soon as we're in Maya, just as soon as we say no to Krishna. And the consequences of saying no to Krishna and the consequences of fruitive activity is unpleasant. And we don't want the unpleasant. We take devotional service. The unpleasant seems to disappear, and then we slacken in devotional service. Complacency and spiritual life don't go well together. But it's good to know if the consequences of complacency, or the consequences of aversion to Krishna, or neglect. It's certainly not the primary reason. The primary reason is who we are is part and parcel of Krishna, and for Krishna's service. And persons who understand that and live their lives accordingly, they don't need this other. What are the consequences if you don't? They're very satisfied in that way of life, of simply being engaged in devotional service. But it's helpful when, as otherwise Vyasadeva wouldn't put it here, or Kapila Deva wouldn't speak it to Devahuti, the consequences of the other option, negligence in the matter of devotional service. And largely, that's the world in which we live. And people suffer in this life, and whether they acknowledge it or not, in the next life also. So, the big picture tells us life is meant for devotional service to Krishna. And neglect of that life is meant for devotional service to Krishna is meant to remind us, get back on track and engage in devotional service to Krishna. Just a couple other thoughts. Each one of us, being practicing devotees, we're called upon from time to time to hear from a practitioner about a struggle that they're undergoing in life, or some part, some aspect of life, career or family or whatever it is, mother-in-law, whatever it is. When those circumstances arise, people want a solution to their problem. And there's a tendency, of course, to kindly help them consider what are solutions to their problem. But the background of all of this shouldn't be forgotten. The background of all of this is part of the consequence of neglect of our mission of human life and the soul's journey to Krishna, and here we are with a complication. It's unwanted. So, problem solving is incomplete without a reminder of what's the root of the problem, and ultimately addressing the root of the problem. Going back to the contact, all of this is starting with chapter 25, where Devahuti asks Kapila, how do I go beyond this undue attachment to family? And she knows very well that her son, part of her family, is the personality of Godhead, but Kardamuni has gone and chose. So she's feeling some unpleasant feelings. And she knows why. Attachment. How do I address the feelings? He goes to the root of the problem. It's you receive sadhu sangha, and here's what a sadhu is, here how you associate with a sadhu, here's the fruit of it, and then you're in this position where you're not attached to temporary anymore. But you're attached to the eternal. That's the solution. So when we're helping people address a problem that they'd like a solution for and solve a problem, depending upon the circumstance, please at least bear in mind what the root of the problem is, and somehow in the course of that discussion help them remember Krishna. Forgetting Krishna is the root of the problem. It's brought us here, it's keeping us here, and that's the problem. Even when the other problem gets solved, that problem is still present. I think I'll stop there and just see. There's two more verses. Maybe tomorrow morning we'll cover the remaining parts of the chapter and go on. Adverse fruit of activities. Practicing the Dhamma?
I was thinking of a situation where a person who is not not a devotee,
yeah,
very pouring their will to increase prosperity, and the motivation behind doing that is, they want to build it for their children.
Sure.
And more security for the children.
Right.
It seems like they are very responsible.
Yes. Laudable. It's wonderful. It's life. It's responsible life.
So where is the a thin line between over endeavoring and neglecting, and
how a person that's gross atheist, like strongly averse to God, then there's a pious person, then there's a beginning in devotional service, and then there's a mature stage of devotional service. Even for materialistic atheists, they have a set of values, and then their values include their family. I mean, not always, but common. So that's laudable, working for the... So there's many things to say, but this, like this chapter 12, there's the highest standard, and if one isn't at the highest standard, practice the regulations of bhakti, it helps you get to the highest standard. If you're not prepared to the regulations of bhakti, try to work for Krishna. And that's karma yoga. And if you can't do that, be situated in the self and be charitable. So, he's not just be charitable, but be situated in the self and be charitable. And what does that mean? There are different levels of what it means to be situated in the self. But try to understand the nature of the self. The true self. Not, self-actualization in the material sense. Maybe I'm meant to be an artist, and so that's self-actualization as I go to art school. It's not that. It's the true self. So without a spiritual core, then I guess what I'm just trying to say is how you would respond to the person depends what's at the core of their spiritual conception of self and their set of, you know, correspondingly their set of values. So that's one part of an answer to, you know, how do you address the person depends on where they are in their spiritual evolution. But then another principle that's really simple, this was in two different venues we were discussing the same topic, just take physical therapy. I had a knee problem, I went to a physical therapist, and you know, after several months of that, the relationship with the therapist developed, and the therapist said, because I was asking, you know, how long do I have to do this, and where does it go, and those kind of things. And the therapist shared a rule of thumb that I use with physical therapy is, it's good to stretch a little bit, you know, beyond what you're comfortable doing, you stretch a little bit, but you stop when it starts to hurt. Or you'll step back and don't do that, because that means it's harming the body. That's the signal you went too far. So, same with other things, with anything that requires discipline. Yoga. You stretch. Not too much. You can harm the body. So, etc. Similarly, with endeavoring for something. Now, the motivation for endeavoring, you just described, it's thinking, this is for my family and the next generations and so on. Over-endeavoring was the question, not what's the purpose of endeavoring. If you can get the person to take a step back and say, what's the purpose of endeavoring? Like, what's the purpose of life? And the nature of all things that are temporary, the nature of all things that are eternal, and isn't it wiser to endeavor for that which is eternal? While you're making in your endeavors, you're going to endeavor for something. Isn't it wiser? So the person isn't able to even have that discussion, then the over-endeavor discussion goes to when the values of your life are put in a compromised position, you're over-endeavoring. For working for your family, you're neglecting so many things, too many things. That's over-endeavoring. Your core values, taking care of... One devotee I know shared with me, his life got so messed up because mom and dad were so busy endeavoring to make money to take care of, you know, the needs of their dependents, that they weren't even around. And they gave everything that money could buy except the things that money can't buy, like themselves. And so they had everything, and they went to the best of schools and indulged with people that were the best of the schools that were like them, parents that just gave them money and didn't give them the human needs. So drugs and sex and everything that money can buy, that, you know, the real satisfaction. So anyway, over-endeavoring means neglecting the very purpose that you're endeavoring for. So what's really valuable in your caring for a family member? Even if they're an atheist or not a spiritually evolved person, a pious person but not so spiritually evolved. So it depends on the person, how you respond or how you help them see what they're doing is not wholesome. Have them go a little beyond their picture of life to the something that's more wholesome. Hopefully they can then come to a position till if they can't do that, they can at least do this. They can't do cultivate knowledge. Can't be self-situated. Read the scriptures. And they'll find answers to this. Yes.
Is it okay to give poor people money?
Poor people money?
Yeah.
Well, it depends. The answer could be yes or no. Or, the answer is maybe. Was Sudama Brahman poor?
Huh?
Sudama Brahman, the school friend of Krishna? Krishna went to school. And he went to school, Sandipani Muni school. Right?
Yeah.
And one of his classmates was Sudama. Sudama was poor. And Krishna gave him money. Right? He gave him more than money. He gave him palaces and fabulous opulence. Or, aside from that, here's a Bhakti Siddhanta story. You've been to Vrindavan, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And one time, when you go to Vrindavan, you'll see sometimes, more than sometimes, you'll see some widows, older ladies that are, just on their own. And they have like a widow's ashram, and sometimes they go in the public and they just sit and chant under beads and have a little place where people can offer something. Donation. So, they're poor people. Bhakti Siddhanta, right, Prabhupada's spiritual master, they were on a visit to Vrindavan. It was the month of Kartik, and so a whole large number of devotees went with Bhakti Siddhanta for 30 days, the whole month, 28 days, following Kartik, different places in Vrindavan. And one time they were at Radha Kund. And with Bhakti Siddhanta were some very wealthy followers, and they weren't giving charity to these poor people. So Bhakti Siddhanta scolded them, saying, "Now you think, because you are a devotee, you don't give charity, because giving charity is a karmakanda, a ritual that people do to get piety, but now you're above that, you're a devotee." Bhakti Siddhanta said, "This is the wrong understanding. Devotees are also seeing all living entities as part and parcel of Krishna. They may, not for the purpose of karmakanda, getting some piety, but being in service to Krishna. If you have wealth, you should distribute that wealth." Now, in a discriminating fashion, not to a bum, that you give him some money and he's going to use it for intoxication or go buy some liquor and get drunk. We don't give money to the person so they can go get drunk. So there, you discriminate which poor people and other poor people to give to. a really simple solution is carry prasadam. And you give the poor person prasadam. You give them money, you give them what money can buy, something that's going to be beneficial for them, not just they can fill their belly, but Krishna's mercy. That's a good way to engage with people that are poor. For prasadam distribution. There's a very nice devotee in Vrindavan. His name is Rupa Raghunath. Rupa Raghunath has set up a whole system in Vrindavan of giving in charity to different people. Like, you know, it starts with prasadam distribution, but when it comes winter time in Vrindavan, right? Especially at night, really cold. And so, in addition to giving on a certain day of the week, they give, bring the widows of Vrindavan together and serve prasadam, they give them a blanket. It's nice. Because they're not going to misuse it. They're not going to go buy a bottle of liquor. They're going to stay warm. So we have to discriminate about who we give them charity to, how they'll use that charity, and what the charity is, what's appropriate for the circumstance. So it depends.
Sure.
Yeah.
So Maharaj, if a person has committed a crime and he has been sentenced to death, what would happen to the soul? Would the soul continue to go onwards and choose another body?
Yes.
Or would it take the form of a ghost?
No. Someone else? Yes, something?
Myself?
Yes.
I do.
Yeah.
Guru Maharaj, Krishna Priya and I are dealing with a situation where we are helping a friend and his wife. His friend was a devotee, practitioner and preacher long while back, but now feels that he was brainwashed by some in the society.
Okay.
And that has messed up his life and so on and so forth. He still kept in touch with me, and his wife is in touch with Krishna Priya, but so he's going through something and he reaches out for help, but I'm wondering if you could share some principles on principles that I could share with them, someone who is now moving away, not moving towards Krishna.
So much depends on the person. What you know, one is you, not what you're asking, which sounds like what you're already doing. You're just being there as a friend, and without making judgments and you know, being careful so they don't feel that you are making judgments, and they're moving as, you know, the circumstances moving them. But yeah, I would say if they're, I'll assume, maybe wrongly, but I'll assume they had some bad experience. And then one shouldn't judge Krishna or devotion to Krishna on the basis of a bad experience. That is to say, Krishna is kind, and devotees of Krishna are kind, and if someone has acted in an unkind manner and that has left you with a bad experience and a bad taste, you know, this is a classic one, but it's not that devotee of Krishna means bad character and you give other people bad experience. be careful, you know, advise them to be careful of overgeneralizing and redirecting the path of their life according to a bad experience. There's you know, there's wholesomeness in the core value of one's relationship with Krishna. Or another, if you're asking for principles to share, having heard Peter Burwash for a number of years at the Festival of Inspiration say the same story every year, when he gave whatever it was, $500 to the Hawaii temple, and shortly after the person ran away with his money. Then next time he was with Prabhupada, he told Prabhupada what happened. And Prabhupada, he was expecting sympathy or something. Instead he got a lesson that said, don't blame your karma on the instrument of your karma. That doesn't mean the bad conduct of stealing $500 was okay. Prabhupada wasn't condoning the bad conduct. But yeah, a principle is, don't blame the instrument of your karma. Now this, you know, devotees don't have karma, right? Because we engage in devotional service. But something, a token reminder of a past misdeed of mine may come in the form of some unpleasant experience in this life. So don't blame the instrument and don't blame Krishna. Doesn't mean the bad experience wasn't a bad experience, or the person that was the instrument of that bad experience, it's okay. We just don't get caught up in the limited temporary events of life. Step back and look at the big picture of life and the soul and the soul's mission in this human form of life. Don't neglect that because of the bad experience or experiences. But those kinds of things can be discussed when the person feels it's not coming from a position of judgment. Good. Delicate. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So you mentioned, you know, those who really understand the true nature of ourselves, of the Atma, they don't need this. But last time when
they don't need which?
So the understanding that adverse
primitive activity. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Got it.
And last time when we were in this house, we discussed a little bit about Queen Kunti.
Yeah.
And Queen Kunti, in her prayers, she asks for more and more misery. But she is obviously in a very high state where she...
She doesn't ask for misery. She asks for the tribulations. She's not experiencing misery. She's experiencing Krishna connection. Go ahead.
So she is obviously in a very high state, and she knows the true nature, and she is constantly in devotional service. I was just trying to understand why is she asking for tribulations, because she is already at that state.
Oh, I think you know the answer. but I'll say it again. Oh yeah, that's the answer. Several things, but the most prominent one is Krishna is very kind. And from the side of the devotee of Krishna, when a difficulty or tribulation arises, there is a tendency to call out more feelingly. And when one calls out more feelingly, Krishna reciprocates. They had, you know, her experience was, again and again, tribulation comes and Krishna comes. The tribulation goes away, Krishna goes away. Another tribulation comes, Krishna comes. He settles the tribulation, Krishna goes. They don't have the tribulations. If that's the association with Krishna, and then the other part is the intense shelter taking, the intensification of shelter taking is commonly a consequence of tribulation, for at least for a pious person, to speak of a pure devotee. You know, there's degrees of feeling and intensity of feeling. So, like, one of the reasons this is different but similar, when Krishna left the rasa dance, he left the rasa dance because the gopis were feeling proud. That's one circumstance, and Krishna doesn't like the devotees to be proud, even gopis, so he left. You know, that feeling of pride was taken away and the feeling of separation from Krishna took its place. And then Krishna came. Because he wanted them to not be, you know, in the wrong space. Now, they're gopis, so how can they be in the wrong space? But, you know, some tinge. Just like in this Raja, in the story of Sudama, it's sometimes said, commentators sometimes say, not only was Sudama very poor and he disliked material opulence, but he was a little bit proud of his renunciation. But Krishna took care of that. No more poverty. Opulence! Okay, now I'm not proud of my detention anymore. My renunciation. But he remained renounced. He continued to sleep on the floor and do what, you know, he was doing before. Although his garments weren't rags and, you know, tattered cloth, opulent external appearance, but you know. That address your question? Okay. Yes.
Good morning, Chair. We talked about complacency. Mm-hmm. My question was at what various stages of devotional service does anyone encounter this complacency?
Any stage. Take your favorite.
So the reason I ask this question is, even while chanting daily Mahamantra, we become a little complacent. So how do we? Any practical tips that we?
Yeah, watch out for it.
We are cognizant about it, but just that it comes in sometimes.
Yeah, so then when you see it comes in sometimes, as soon as you recognize it comes in, then you'll sit straight. It sits straight. By that I mean, you know, restore, connect with Krishna in a submissive manner. This is very detrimental, very unwholesome, very disrespectful. So reconnect. Resubmit yourself to Krishna. Just see my condition. You pick me up and I become complacent. Yes?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So my question is about endeavoring with a limited knowledge or with incomplete knowledge. Two examples that comes to me is one at work, in a technology we don't know anything about it, but we do Google or we take something which is already available that's called open source, and then sometimes we write something on top of it, or sometimes we ship it like that and we get billed. The companies charge a lot of amount on that. So we are contributing to that. Another thing is like...
I didn't get the first example. You Google something and you get some information and then you ship it?
Yes, ship it to the customers.
Information? You ship information?
Right, that piece of a code or something. So
he's taking advantage of someone else's work,
right.
Yeah.
And making money out of it. His company is authorizing him to do it.
So that's... because I don't have the knowledge about it, but the information is already available. That's called open source. So we take that information, sometimes we write something on top of it, or if there is a requirement, we write it, otherwise we don't even write it, anything on it. So we give this to the clients, and the company charges.
You say you're a broker. You can hire, someone can hire a broker to sell their house, or just sell their house.
So
you're an information broker.
There you
go. So is it illegal? It's illegal or not?
It's legal.
Yeah. It's legal, okay. I mean, a person can decide to go to you because you're an information broker, or go Google it themselves. That's their choice. And you're a company that you're an information broker. They come to you because they don't want to Google it. They want you to Google it. And they pay you for it. They do take a commission for Googling it for them.
And my other question, this is like, so you are teaching something where you have gained some knowledge, but knowledge is not complete.
That's common, isn't it?
That's quite common. Like, say for example, like...
I know many examples. So what's the question?
My question is it all right to teach what you know?
Yes.
And get paid for that?
Oh, and get paid for it. You're speaking in the workplace, or you're speaking in Krishna consciousness?
It's not about Krishna consciousness.
Oh, okay. You're asking in the workplace, is it ethical that you give information, but you don't really know the full extent of that information?
Right.
Well, that's life, isn't it? Who has full extent of information about anything? Generally, it's, you know, half information, and the other half is wrong. That's life. Of course it's cheating. You know, that's how life is. What are you going to do? Become a farmer. Then you don't have to cheat anybody. You know, in information, just throw a vegetable in the grain and sell them in the marketplace. You know, who is it that has full information about anything? My thoughts are going to our dear president. He says so much garbage. And he's our president. How embarrassing. He's an animal and he's our president. He can say anything, and he says anything, and he, you know, throws his weight around. People like him. Some people like him. Enough people to make him president. Sheesh. So, now, is it ethical to, you don't have complete information and you share what, you know, take any profession, suppose a medical profession. Who knows? They're experimenting all the time. Sometimes they kill people. Sometimes they cure people. Sometimes it's somewhere in between. Then they experiment some more. And that's the profession. So they have malpractice insurance and it costs half the money that they earn. Insurance companies are laughing to the bank. It's just the nature of the place. There are professions that are more ethical than others. There are professions that are less ethical than others. It depends on, you know, what position you have, whether you can be fully honest with your ethics or not. Think of like what's coming to mind is Bhaktivinoda Thakur, when he graduated from college, he was from the aristocratic family. His father had died. So somebody in his, you know, family relations gave him a high position in some business. One of the first things he did was, in checking the accounts, he found that somebody was double charged, so he gave the money back. That they were, you know, they're overcharged or something like that. And the owner said, you know, you're fired. You have the wrong profession. You should become a teacher or something. Because in this profession, you don't do that. So he started working on becoming a teacher, etc. Because some professions are less clean, some professions are more clean, but even the teaching profession, to be a teacher, you have to be a self-realized soul. Otherwise, you're unethical. Right? And being a parent. Right?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. So, There's the ideal standard, and you strive towards that standard to your capacity. Okay, looks like we're done. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah. Yeah.